Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Good to be back.
Today we're looking into the sources you've shared to explore the, well, the really intricate history and current situation between Kurds and Arabs in the region we know as Kurdistan.
Right. Our goal here is to pull out the key insights, the interesting facts, basically the most relevant points from this material. We want to help you get up to speed quickly on what is, let's face it, a very complex relationship.
Yeah, it really is. The sources highlight this long, tangled history, cohabitation, sometimes cooperation, but also definitely conflict. So let's get started.
Okay.
The sources kick things off with the arrival of Arab conquests, 7th century CE, moving into the mountainous areas where Kurdish tribes were living. This really set the stage.
And it wasn't, you know, a simple walkover. The material talks about fierce resistance from Kurdish tribes around 638 AD. It actually went on for nearly a century.
Wow, a century.
Yeah, and it seems it wasn't just about religion. Fundamentally, it was about holding on to their autonomy, you know, against these outside forces.
And one really crucial pattern the sources point out is this idea of Islamization without total Arabization.
Exactly. Kurds mostly kept their own languages, their distinct culture, even after converting to Islam. That resilience, that's a thread you see again and again.
But it wasn't all resistance, right? There was integration, too.
Yes, definitely. The sources mention Kurds serving as fighters, Ghazis they are called, under the Umayyads, acting as a buffer zone. There was even intermarriage at the elite level, like the mother of the last Umayyad caliph, Marwan II. Sources say she was Kurdish.
Okay, fast forward to the Abbasid era, starting 750 AD. The central power starts to weaken.
Right. And that's when you see these Kurdish emirates popping up. Yeah. Basically, local governments led by tribal chiefs.
Names like the Marwanids, the Hasanway Hines.
Those are the ones. And the sources really emphasize how much these emirates depended on Kurdish tribesmen for their military strength.
So they were distinct regional powers. But the material also flags a big internal problem. Fragmentation.
Uh-huh. Tribal rivalries. Disputes between families or tribes. It often made them vulnerable. The Hasanway Hides, for instance, apparently fell apart because of internal conflicts.
Still, despite that weakness, were there positive periods?
Oh, yes. The sources mention periods of stability, even cultural flourishing. Nasser al-Dalla of the Marwanids, for example, is noted for boosting urban development, patronizing scholars.
And their relationship with the Abbasid Caliph.
It was, well, pragmatic seems the right word. Often nominal allegiance just to keep things stable, but sometimes conflict too.
And how were Kurds seen by, say, early Arab or Persian writers?
Initially, sometimes a bit vaguely. The term Kurd might have been used broadly for various nomadic groups, suggesting maybe a lack of detailed understanding. They were sometimes seen as marginal, maybe rebellious. Sources mention early uprisings in Mosul.
But that changed.
Yeah, by the 12th century or so, they were more clearly recognized as a distinct ethnic group, even if those tribal divisions remained really important. And you had Kurdish scholars making contributions in big centers like Baghdad.
Okay, then we get to a really unique moment in the sources. The Ayyubid dynasty, founded by Salah-ud-Din or Saladin.
Hugely significant. And he was, as the sources point out, of Kurdish origin, from Tikrit.
His rise sounds pivotal. He served the Zengids, then displaced the Fatimids in Egypt.
And established this powerful Sunni dynasty. At its height, it covered Egypt, Syria, Palestine, Upper Mesopotamia, Yemen, a vast area.
And famously, uniting Muslim forces against the Crusaders, retaking Jerusalem.
Exactly. And this period is so important because it shows Kurdish leadership, not just locally, but right at the heart of the Arab-majority Islamic world. It really complicates any simple narrative of just, you know, conflict or domination.
So an instance of Kurdish ascendancy governing diverse populations.
Precisely. United under Islam. Now, militarily, the sources say they initially had strong Kurdish contingents.
But that shifted.
It seems so. Later, they relied more heavily on Turkish Mamluks. And the sources do mention internal tensions, friction between Kurdish and Turkish factions within the Ayyubid setup.
What about culturally?
They were big patrons of Sunni learning, building madrasas. Known for military engineering, too, the Citadel in Cairo is an example. And this era saw more Kurds moving into big cities like Cairo, Damascus, Aleppo, establishing their own quarters, mosques. A kind of early Kurdish diaspora.
Okay, so summing up this pre-20th century period, the sources show this amazing cultural resilience, Islamization, but keeping their identity.
Right, but also that persistent challenge of internal fragmentation, limiting bigger political unity.
And yet the Ayyubid example really stands out. It shows that periods of Kurdish leadership and shared governance in that wider world were definitely possible, actually transformative.
Now, things get even more complex with the arrival of the Turks. First the Seljuks, then the Ottomans.
Adding another layer, shifting alliances, different levels of autonomy.
Exactly. The Seljuks come in during the 11th century, extending their control. When they encountered existing groups like the Marwanids, they demanded allegiance.
Was there cooperation too?
Yes. The sources indicate the Seljuks recognized the strategic value of Kurdish warriors. They cooperated in campaigns, particularly against the Byzantines. Think about the Battle of Manzikert. 1071.
A major turning point.
Huge. And the sources mention something like 10,000 Kurdish horsemen contributing to that Seljuk victory, which really opened up Anatolia.
Wasn't it around this time the name Kurdistan first appeared officially?
That's right. Under Seljuk Sultan Ahmad Sanjar around 1150. The sources say he formally created a province called Kurdistan, covering a southern part of the homeland. That's different from earlier Arab geographers who just called it Al-Jabal, the mountains.
But the relationship wasn't always smooth sailing.
No, far from it. The Seljuks could be opportunistic, sometimes undermining allies when it suited them. It shows how power dynamics were constantly shifting.
Okay, moving on to the Ottomans, a really significant phase for Kurd-Arab relations. First contact during their expansion against the Safavids early 16th century.
Yes, and the sources pinpoint the Battle of Chaldiran in 1514 as absolutely pivotal. Kurdish emirs, apparently advised by Idris Bitlisi, sided with the Sunni Ottoman Sultan Selim I against the Shia Safavids.
And Kurdish forces were key to the Ottoman win.
Crucial, according to the material. This led to the Ottomans annexing eastern Anatolia and northern Mesopotamia. And the big outcome.
Autonomy for the Kurdish emirates.
Considerable autonomy, yes. Hereditary rule, tax exemptions, responsibility for defending the frontiers. For emirates like Saran, Baban, Botan. And this system lasted for centuries, from 1514 right up until the mid-1800s.
A mutually beneficial arrangement, it sounds like. Ottomans get border security, Kurds get self-governance.
Pretty much. But that started to unravel in the mid-19th century. The Ottoman Tanzimat reforms, aiming to modernize, centralize.
That meant dismantling those autonomous structures.
Exactly. And that sparked Kurdish revolts. People like Badr Khan Beg in 1847. The sources are quite clear these were mostly about restoring that lost autonomy, not really about secession yet.
But they were suppressed.
Yes, the Ottomans had a more modernized military by then. There was a brief Kurdistan Eyalet or province, but centralization continued.
The sources mention a temporary change under Sultan Abdulhamid II, pan-Islamism.
Right. Late 19th century, he tried to unite Muslim subjects, Kurds, Arabs, others against external threats and minority nationalisms. He even created the Hamidi cavalry, mainly Kurdish tribesmen, for border defense and, controversially, used against Armenian nationalists. Tribal leaders gained influence again.
But then another shift. The Young Turks in 1908.
Yeah, their focus on Turkish nationalism started to alienate non-Turkish Muslims like the Kurds. Religious solidarity wasn't enough anymore. This fed into early Kurdish nationalist feelings. And during WWI, the Ottomans even deported some Kurds to disrupt tribal power.
So, within Ottoman Kurdistan itself, Kurds and Arabs often live close together. Same provinces.
Often, yes. Places like Mosul, Baghdad, Aleppo, Vilayets. Shared Sunni Islam was a common bond, plus the Ottoman millet system recognized Muslims as a community.
Tribal structure is still powerful.
Very much so, for both groups. The Ottomans often worked through local agas and sheikhs. Local life was diverse, coexistence, trade, but also competition for resources, alliances, feuds, you know, complex local realities.
Economic interaction. Like Kurdish nomads trading with settled Arab farmers.
That was significant, yeah. Livestock, agricultural goods. But Ottoman policies could also sow division. During WWI, the sources suggest Turkish nationalists sometimes used rhetoric trying to pit Kurds against Arabs involved in the Arab revolt. And then, the big collapse. The Ottoman Empire's decline and fall after WWI just blew everything up, leading to this total reordering of the Middle East.
Which sets the stage for Arab and Kurdish nationalisms clashing with colonial powers and these new state borders.
Exactly. So that pre-20th century picture is one of shared religion, living together under empires, flashes of Kurdish autonomy, but always that internal fragmentation. And finally, the impact of empire decline and centralization. There was a historical precedent for self-governance, though.
Okay, let's have a quick chai break.
Oh, excellent timing.
Ooh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Ah, hello, Hannah. Welcome.
How's the chai today? Is it good and sweet? Or is it, you know, a bit bitter? Might need more sugar.
Smells wonderful.
Sips.
Ah, that's lovely. Just right today. Not bitter at all. Perfect.
Perfectly brewed. Delicious.
All right. Feeling refreshed. back to our exploration. So the 20th century. The sources describe this as a really traumatic turning point. Empires collapse, Kurdistan gets carved up.
And those hopes for self-determination are basically dashed. This leads directly to new conflicts with these emerging Arab-majority states.
After World War I, the Allies initially seemed supportive.
For a moment, yes. The Treaty of Sevres in 1920 actually included articles proposing an autonomous Kurdish region, potentially including Mosul, even with a path towards independence.
Wow. So the first major international recognition of Kurds as a distinct group with potential statehood rights.
Pretty much. Kurdish delegations were actively lobbying in Paris, but, well, it was a very short-lived promise.
Sevres failed. Completely. Rejected by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and the Turkish National Movement, the Allies weren't willing or able to enforce it. Priorities shifted. And then came the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923.
Which, crucially,
made no mention of Kurdish autonomy or a state. Kurdish lands were definitively split between Turkey, British Mandate, Iraq, French Mandate, Syria, and a Persia, which became Iran.
The impact must have been huge.
Profound disappointment. It basically institutionalized Kurdish statelessness, making them the largest stateless ethnic group in the Middle East. That shift from Sevres to Lausanne, it became this core narrative of betrayal, a major grievance.
So Kurds find themselves as minorities in these new Arab states, quarters cutting right across tribal lands.
Exactly. In Iraq, under the British, the oil-rich Mosul Vilayet was attached to Iraq despite Turkish and Kurdish claims, an Arab-led government in Baghdad. Well, the stage was set for conflict from the start.
Early resistance. Sheikh Mahmoud Barzanji.
Yes. He proclaimed a short-lived kingdom of Kurdistan, but it was suppressed by British and Iraqi forces pretty quickly.
And Syria, under the French.
Kurdish areas in the north and northeast were just incorporated. The French period allowed some Kurdish activity, but the ultimate goal was an Arab state. This laid the groundwork for future tensions between Kurdish identity and the centralizing Syrian state after independence. And then you have the rise of Arab nationalism as this powerful, dominant force across the region.
Anti-colonial focus on Arab unity.
Right, which was, as the sources explain, inherently challenging for non-Arab minorities like the Kurds. The emphasis on a single Arab identity, centralized control. It clashed directly with Kurdish identity and their desire for autonomy or self-determination.
Leading to state policies of assimilation, suppression.
Yes. Systematic policies aimed at creating homogeneous national identities, particularly intense in Iraq under the Ba'athists, especially after 1968.
In strategic areas, like Kirkuk with its oil.
Absolutely. The sources detail methods like forced displacement, moving Kurds and others out, settling Arabs and trying to literally change the demographics, suppression of identity too, restricting the Kurdish language, culture, sometimes even denying Kurds existed as a distinct group, calling them mountain Arabs.
And the oil in Kirkuk just poured fuel on the fire.
Massively. Control over resources became central. It intertwined ethnic politics with competition for wealth, making the Arabization drive there particularly violent.
What about Syria? Similar patterns.
Similar Ba'athist influence after 1963. You had that infamous 1962 census that just stripped around 120,000 Kurds of their citizenship overnight, made them stateless Ajnabi or unregistered Maktoumin.
Denied basic rights.
Completely. And then the Arab Belt Project in the 70s, confiscating Kurdish lands along the Turkish border, settling Arab families, trying to break ties with Kurds in Turkey and change the demography, plus widespread cultural and linguistic suppression.
So the core conflict, as the sources frame it for the 20th century, is this clash. State-building projects based on Arab identity versus the Kurdish fight for survival and self-rule.
That's the primary driver of conflict and instability throughout the period, according to this material.
How did Kurdish communities respond?
Through cultural preservation, political organizing, and quite often armed uprisings. Iraq saw a particularly sustained and intense struggle. You had early figures like Ahmed Barzani, then his brother Mustafa Barzani became iconic.
Leading major revolts.
Yeah.
The first Iraqi Kurdish war in the 60s.
Right. The KDP fighting for autonomy against Arabization. It was protracted guerrilla warfare. It ended with the March 1970 autonomy agreement, which promised autonomy.
But it didn't hold.
Largely unimplemented, and it collapsed, leading to another war in 1975 and defeat for the Kurds when Iran cut off support. This led to even more intense repression by Baghdad.
But the resistance continued.
It did. New groups formed, like the PUK under Jalal Talabani in 1975, continuing the insurgency. Then came that watershed moment in 1991, the uprising after the Gulf War.
Mass protests, Peshmerga advances.
And crucially, international intervention. Operation Provide Comfort, the no-fly zones. This led to Iraqi forces withdrawing from large parts of the north and the creation of the de facto autonomous Kurdistan region, the KRG.
What about Syria during this time? Less large-scale fighting until recently.
Generally, yes, until the civil war in 2011.
Wow.
They faced political repression, but sometimes participated in Syrian politics, often having to downplay their Kurdish identity. There were flashpoints, though, like the Qamishli events in 2004, clashes and protests met with a harsh crackdown.
So the 20th century pattern seems to be this cycle. Kurdish demands, state repression, uprisings, suppression, maybe temporary deals that fall apart, and then the tensions just resurface.
Exactly. A failure of accommodation, really, and an unwavering Kurdish refusal to give up their identity or demands. Mistrust just got deeper and deeper.
And the sources detail one particularly horrific event from this period, the Anfal campaign.
Yes, 1988. Under Saddam Hussein's regime, it wasn't just targeting Peshmerga fighters. The sources are clear this was genocidal in intent and scale, part of that systematic Arabization.
Aimed at ethnically cleansing Kurds.
From strategic areas, yes. Crushing autonomy hopes through sheer force and demographic change. The methods were brutal and systematic, destroying thousands of villages, mass killings, summary executions. Tens of thousands of civilians, mostly men and boys, ended up in mass graves.
And the use of chemical weapons.
Repeatedly. Mustard gas, nerve agents. Halabja is the most infamous example. Thousands killed instantly. Hundreds of thousands who survived were forcibly moved to these desolate camps.
The impact on Kurd-Arab relations in Iraq must be immense.
Profound. Anfal created this deep, deep trauma and mistrust towards any central government in Baghdad. It solidified a narrative of Kurdish victimhood, understandably.
And the state settling Arab families in those depopulated areas.
Poison relations at the local level, too. From a Kurdish viewpoint, those settlers were benefiting directly from their suffering and dispossession. Anfal really reinforced Kurdish demands for self-protection, for self-governance. It also generated international sympathy that helped pave the way for the KRG after 91. Its legacy just cast this incredibly long shadow. Okay, let's shift to the contemporary period. Things change again with the fall of Saddam in 2003 and then the Syrian civil war starting in 2011.
New geopolitical realities, new opportunities for Kurdish groups to assert themselves.
Right. In Iraqi Kurdistan, the KRG gets formal constitutional recognition in 2005 as a federal region, but the disputes with Baghdad continue and relations with Arab communities are complex.
What are the main friction points between the KRG and Baghdad, according to the sources?
Several key ones keep coming up. Budget allocations and salaries, that's chronic. Baghdad holds back funds, says the KRG isn't meeting oil obligations. The KRG says Baghdad is weaponizing finances to undermine its autonomy. We saw reports just in early 2025 about Baghdad halting funding again. KRG disputing the claims.
Mm.
It causes real salary crises.
And oil and gas themselves.
The central conflict, really. Yeah. The KRG developed its own oil sector, exporting via Turkey. Baghdad, backed by the federal Supreme Court, says that's unconstitutional. There was that pipeline suspension from March 2023. It's a fundamental clash. KRG wants economic self-sufficiency. Baghdad insists on federal sovereignty over national wealth.
All feeding into that bigger struggle over autonomy versus centralization. The 2017 independence referendum backlash really highlighted that.
Definitely. And then there are the disputed territories. Article 140 in the Constitution was meant to resolve their status, normalization, census, referendum, but it just hasn't happened.
These are the ethnically mixed areas. Kirkuk, Sinjar.
Kirkuk, parts of Nineveh, Diyala, Salah Adin. Areas subject to that historical Arabization. They're stuck in political and security limbo, constant flashpoints. Kirkuk, especially oil-rich, multi-ethnic, claimed by everyone.
Peshmerga took it from ISIS, but then federal forces pushed them out after the referendum.
Correct. In 2017, now its governance is super contested, and those recent reports about renewed Arab resettlement efforts just add to the tension.
And Sinjar, predominantly Yazidi.
Yes, and they suffered terribly under ISIS genocide. Its status is disputed, security is fragmented, multiple armed groups are vying for control, KDP, Peshmerga, federal forces, Shia militias, PMF, PKK-affiliated groups. A 2020 Baghdad herbal agreement to normalize things hasn't really worked, partly due to mistrust between factions. Relations there are deeply scarred.
So these issues, constitutional gray areas, resources, disputed lands, they just keep driving conflict.
They really do. They're like microcosms of all Iraq's bigger challenges.
Yeah.
Power sharing, minority rights, dealing with the past, national identity. Now, what about Arab communities living inside the KRG proper, not the disputed areas?
The sources mention different groups. Long-term residents, migrants, and IDPs.
Right. Internally displaced persons. The KRG became a major haven, especially after ISIS took Mosul in 2014. Hundreds of thousands of Arabs fled there from other provinces.
How many are still there?
As of late 2024, early 2025, the sources suggest over 100,000 are still in camps, plus others living outside camps. Conditions are tough. Despite aid from the KRG, UN, NGOs, many face poverty, food insecurity.
What's the policy on them returning home?
KRG policy is voluntary, safe return, but there are big obstacles. Ongoing insecurity in their home areas, destroyed homes and infrastructure, no jobs. The federal government's plan to close the camps keeps getting postponed. Finding durable solutions, return, integration, or relocation needs IDP input, and getting civil documents sorted is vital.
Has the treatment of Arab IDPs by KRG authorities raised concerns?
It has. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International issued reports, particularly around 2015-2016, alleging discriminatory practices by KRG security forces, Peshmerga, Asayish, in areas retaken from ISIS.
Allegations like bombing.
Preventing Arab families from returning while allowing Kurds back, cordoning off Arab villages, arbitrary detentions of Arab men, even demolishing Arab homes.
How did the KRG respond?
They generally denied systematic discrimination, citing security needs, the threat from ISIS sympathizers, or damage happening during combat. Some Arab tribal leaders also contested the scale of destruction claims, so it's a complex picture. The KRI offered refuge to huge numbers, but in contested zones especially, some Arabs faced hardship, insecurity, and these allegations of discrimination.
What about Arabs who aren't IDPs, the established residents?
They're a minority in the core KRG provinces, like Erbil, Sulaymaniyah, Dohuk. Some have historical roots, others migrated since 2003 for security or economic reasons. They seem pretty integrated, economically involved in commerce, real estate.
Socially, culturally.
Daily interaction happens, Arabic is spoken, there's social mixing. The KRG officially promotes diversity. But there might be underlying anxieties, like some Kurdish concerns about Arabization of certain spaces.
Do they have political representation?
The KRG parliament has quotas for Christians, Turkmen, Armenians, but not specifically for Arabs in the core provinces. The rationale given is that Arabs are the majority in Iraq overall. How much influence they have formally isn't that clear from the sources. A 2016 UNHCR report noted the rule of law could sometimes be influenced by ethnicity or connections, and some IDPs mistrusted KRG security regarding arbitrary detention risks, though this wasn't presented as solely an Arab issue.
So it's crucial to distinguish between the situation of Arabs in those contested disputed territories.
And it's about control, land, resources.
Versus Arabs living as a settled minority or immigrant group within the KRG proper, where the issues are more about civil rights, economic integration, daily life.
Exactly. The policies and dynamics are quite different. Okay, let's pivot to Syrian Kurdistan. The civil war starting in 2011 created a power vacuum that allowed Syrian Kurdish groups, mainly the PYD and its armed wing, the YPG, to establish de facto autonomy.
The Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, ANEs, often called Rojava.
Right, and it governs really diverse territories, including large Arab communities, especially after they pushed ISIS out of areas like Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor.
How does their governance model work, according to the sources?
It's based on democratic confederalism, emphasizing grassroots democracy, decentralization, multi-ethnic coexistence. They revised their foundational document, the social contract, in late 2023, restructuring administration and reinforcing these principles.
Multi-ethnic governance is key then. How are Arabs represented?
It's a core principle, aiming for equal participation Kurds, Arabs, Syriac Assyrians, others. Incorporating Arab communities, especially in majority Arab areas they liberated, was essential. The social contract makes Arabic an official language alongside Kurdish and Syriac. They promote this idea of a democratic nation.
So Arabs are in local councils, in the security forces?
Yes, local councils have mixed representation, including Arab tribes, and Arab fighters form a significant part, maybe even the majority, of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF.
What about managing resources like oil?
That's sensitive. The ANE's economy relies heavily on oil and gas, mostly from areas in Jazeera and Deir ez-Zor, which are predominantly Arab. How those revenues are controlled and distributed is a major point of contention.
And their relationship with the central government in Damascus, historically not recognized.
Never recognized by the Assad regime, which always wanted centralization, the ANES has sought some form of federal or decentralized arrangement.
But the fall of Assad in December 2024 changed everything.
Potentially, yes. There are reports from March 2025 about a possible agreement between the SDF commander and Syria's new interim president.
What might that include?
Reportedly, things like a nationwide ceasefire, integrating the SDF into a new national army, constitutional recognition for Kurdish rights, and crucially, returning control of oil, gas, and border crossings to the state.
So negotiations are ongoing. A critical moment.
Absolutely. It could reshape Kurd-Arab relations at the state level in Syria. The Iwanis' own evolution, like the 2023 social contract, shows a pragmatic effort to adapt to governing Arab-majority areas and build legitimacy. But real power-sharing and addressing deep-seated grievances. That's still the challenge, as the Deir ez-Zor clashes showed. And those clashes really highlight the tension beneath the surface of coexistence in Syria.
So there's cooperation, shared governance efforts fighting ISIS together,
yeah,
but also significant local tensions.
Exactly. The Deir ez-Zor clashes in late 2023 were the most serious example. They kicked off after the SDF arrested a local Arab commander, Abu Kala, for alleged corruption. Arab tribal fighters then fought the SDF.
What were the underlying causes, according to the sources?
A mix of things. Local Arab grievances were key. Complaints about Yani's corruption, feeling that oil revenues weren't benefiting local communities, forced conscription into the SDF, poor basic services, and a perception of Kurdish dominance in the administration. Some also objected to Yani's social policies, like on gender equality.
And external actors played a role.
The sources suggest they exacerbated, maybe even instigated, the situation. The former Syrian regime, Iran-backed militias trying to destabilize the SDF. Turkey also reportedly supported some tribal fighters because it opposes the PYDYPG.
How did it end?
The SDF, with support from the U.S.-led coalition, managed to suppress the uprising. Afterwards, the ANES leadership acknowledged some grievances, and the SDF commander promised reforms restructuring local councils, better Arab representation addressing local demands. But sporadic clashes continued, showing things remain fragile.
So that issue of resource sharing, especially oil wealth, is a major driver of tension.
Primary tension point. Arab communities feel marginalized, not getting a fair share. It's a powerful economic grievance that can be mobilized.
Plus governance issues, poor services, lack of trust.
Yes. Inadequate services, water, electricity, healthcare, education in many Arab areas, a perceived lack of transparency, maybe dominance by Kurdish cadres. Sometimes locals trust traditional tribal reconciliation methods more than ANES processes, especially for sensitive issues like reintegrating former ISIS affiliates. And human rights groups have raised concerns about detentions, particularly of ISIS suspects and families, which impacts local perceptions of justice.
It sounds like a paradox.
Yeah.
The SDF, with Arab support,
yeah,
liberated these areas from ISIS.
But the ANES administration is struggling to translate that military success into effective, legitimate governance that wins the peace. It needs to address those economic grievances, show tangible benefits from resources, and build genuinely inclusive structures that local Arabs and tribes see as fair.
And external actors just keep stirring the pot.
They absolutely exploit these vulnerabilities. Turkey is a major factor. It sees the YPG-SDF as an extension of the PKK, a terrorist group.
Turkish military incursions.
Since 2016, yes. They've occupied Kurdish-majority areas like Afrin, Tel Abyad, Ras Al Ain, displaced hundreds of thousands of Kurds and others. There are reports of demographic changes, with Turkish-backed Syrian militias settling Arab and Turkmen IDPs there. This obviously damages Kurd-Arab relations through displacement, resentment, competition for resources. Turkey actively supports groups opposing the Arab ends.
What about the Syrian regime before and after Assad?
Historically complex. Assad's regime suppressed Kurds, but sometimes cooperated tactically with the YPG-SDF against shared enemies like Turkey or other rebels. But it never recognized the AIS. The former regime and Iran were often accused of trying to foment unrest among Arab tribes against the SDF.
And now, post-Assad, that March 2025 potential agreement.
It could reshape things, but challenges remain. Will the new interim government push for centralization? Can mistrust be overcome? What role will Turkey play? It's very much in flux.
And the ISIS threat hasn't completely gone away.
No, they operate as an insurgency, exploiting socioeconomic problems, governance gaps, intercommunal tensions to recruit and destabilize. This forces the SDF to maintain a heavy security focus, diverting resources from development and services. The U.S. partnership with the SDF against ISIS was crucial in empowering them, but if counterterrorism efforts are perceived badly by locals, it can breed mistrust and create openings for ISIS.
Okay, so we've covered a huge amount of ground, from those early encounters and empires through the partition, the conflicts of the 20th century, Anfal. right up to the really complex situations in Iraq and Syria today.
Yeah, and the key takeaways from the sources seem pretty clear. Kurd-Arab relations are this incredibly dynamic mix of shared history, distinct identities, political goals often clashing, competition over vital resources, and constant meddling by external powers.
Recurring themes like Islamization without full Arabization, that persistent Kurdish internal fragmentation, and the big one, the drive for self-determination pushing against state centralization.
Exactly. And understanding this history, this context, is just essential if you want to make sense of the current political landscape, the ongoing challenges, the potential opportunities in the Middle East. What happens with these communities really impacts regional stability.
Which leaves us with a final thought, something for you, the listener, to consider. How can the pursuit of distinct national or regional identities, Kurdish, Arab, or others, coexist with the need for genuinely inclusive governance? How do you build shared prosperity in these multi-ethnic regions, especially when you have this legacy of historical trauma and constant external interference?
Is long-term stability even possible without fundamentally addressing the core grievances of groups who feel marginalized? It's a tough question, and one the sources really compel us to think about.
Indeed. Well, thank you for spending this time exploring these sources with us today in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. We hope this exploration has helped you get quickly well-informed on this vital and complex topic.